Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, a full-service marketing and commerce platform that helps restaurants get discovered, make more money, and engage their diners. Join over 8,000 restaurants already using Bento Box today to deliver better hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history here at Heritage Radio Network. And when we think of Tibet, I venture to say that we think of vast mountains and soaring heights, maybe herds of mountainous animals like yaks and goats, and of course, Buddhist monks in their colorful robes. But I really do venture that rarely one of us thinks of the food of Tibet. I mean, there are a few Tibetan restaurants, particularly in New York City. And when I say few, I mean very few. But it seems that for the general population, little is known about the food or even the cuisine. Is there a cuisine? But now, fortunately, we have a link to what was long missing from the global culinary map. My guests today are Julie Kleeman and Yeshi Jampa. They have put together the first comprehensive Tibetan cookbook and the only collection of its kind in the United States. This is an authentic exploration of cooking, eating, and living like they do in the Himalayas. Julie is an award-winning food writer, and Yeshi is a chef and restaurant and recipe developer from Tibet. Together, they're the award-winning team behind Taste Tibet Restaurant and Food Stall in Oxford, England, and now the authors of Taste Tibet, Family Recipes from the Himalayas from Interlink Books. The book is really truly an insight into a culture and its cuisine that is little known, and it really explains how to cook these ancient dishes in the way that perhaps Buddhist monks cook them in the Himalayas. It really captures the spiritual and personal essence of this unique cuisine as written in the foreword of the book. And I thank you both. First of all, I welcome you both to my show. And thank you for writing this wonderful book. It's the stories are delightful and touching, and the recipes are approachable, and I love the head notes. And Yeshi, I love all your comments on the cooking. It makes it really a very user-friendly book.
Thank you so much.
So I would like to know, I mean, given the, as you have even written, I think, Julian, you wrote in the beginning, that given the geography of Tibet and its relative isolation, Tibetan people have always eaten what's locally available and in season. And
that's right.
Over time, they've come to understand, you say, the innate properties of the herbs and the vegetables and the meat that they consume. Can you elaborate a little more on that for me? Both of you, please. You know, whomever.
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, most parts of Tibet are quite isolated, one region to the next. And I mean, I think where Yeshi grew up certainly wasn't near any kind of hospital, and most parts of Tibet, the same would be true. So for millennia, people living in the Tibetan region learned how to cure themselves of acute or chronic illness using herbs, plants, and through an effective diet. And these are teachings that have been passed down from generation to generation and that people still very much lean on, even in the modern day. Yeshe's family, who are still a long way from a good clinic or hospital, will rarely seek medical attention unless it's really an emergency. So focusing on a good diet is the number one way for self-healing.
Well, it certainly appears from the recipes and from your explanations that it seems very healthy, and there's no, what can I say? There are no extraneous snack food other than, you know, some, of course, some sweets and, you know, but nothing that is not necessary. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I think the key thing is that Tibetan people, I mean, obviously some things are changing in the modern day, but they have always cooked from scratch and using ingredients that are locally available and seasonal, perhaps sometimes swapping seed varieties or some crops one village to the next, but essentially understanding exactly where their food has come from, whether that is vegetables, fruit, or meat as well. They would usually consume one of their own herd. So there's a very direct connection between the kind of their day-to-day life and what ends up on their plates, as a result of which all of us are kind of familiar with the concept of, you know, if we eat what is locally available, that's likely to be what is best for us. But I think that Tibetans are kind of living proof of that, even in the 21st century, when many cultures have moved kind of quite far from that concept. Many people in Tibet are still very much living that kind of lifestyle, and Yeshe's family included.
Well, in fact, you wrote that the day-to-day existence of your family, Yeshe, do have some modern additions and conveniences, but that the food on the plates remains largely the same as your ancestors going back many years.
Yeah, that's, you know, the my family. Yeah, just like, I don't know how many generations, like, you know, my both parents really good cook, and I learned at a very, very young age, probably like at 19 years old, and just, you know, always in my home, the cooking, I saw it very young age, and then I just, I helped to cook, but in home, not that much, but we summertimes, I go with my dad on the mountains. And we took the sheep's yaks 6 months. We stay with on the high mountains on the Himalaya, and they just move around on the mountains and the values, different values. Because in the summer we feed the animals like a different variety on the mountains to the kind of grass and different grass, like a kind of basically medicine for the animals. That's why we look after the animals. And we know the animals like meat, completely organic. We know that.
So you led that nomadic lifestyle. You were gone for 6 months at a time.
My father's family is completely nomad for the many, I don't know how many years, you know, the many generations. We are born, my family is semi-nomadic. So we have land and we have lots of animals.
So you have a home to come back to
after
you've been away.
But they're never far from the animals. So during the 6 months of the year that the family is not out on high pastures of the plateau, as Yeshe mentioned, helping the animals move from one grazing land to the next, the animals live inside the same home, so they occupy the ground floor of the house, and they'll still be looking after those animals for the 6 months of the year that they're not outside. And those animals also provide some warmth and heat to the house. So the family live upstairs, still tending their herd, but, you know, all sharing one house.
So what? Tell me, just as a kind of a broad stroke description. What is how would you describe the cuisine of Tibet, the basic flavors and influences?
So I think this really depends where you are and what kind of life you live. So for nomads who spend 6 months or you know, pretty much 12 months of the year away from home, the diet is usually very basic, and it's restricted to those crops that are able to thrive at high elevation, namely barley, and then also the produce of essentially the yak, which is, with its kind of proportionately larger lungs, the animal that is best designed to survive at such high altitude. So barley is usually made into, it's called tsamba, which is, at first the barley is roasted and then it's milled to the consistency of flour. And with this barley flour, you can either, well, it's very versatile. You can have it in the morning as a porridge with hot water and maybe something sweet. And it can also be rolled into dense energy balls. Our kids eat it that way before they head off to school in the mornings. And mm-hmm. you can even make bread out of it. That's something that can also go in your tea. But when you're at lower elevation, you obviously have access to a much wider variety of vegetables in particular, and also fruit. And there the cuisine becomes a lot more varied. And so, you know, you're still cold. You're not as you're not at 5,000 meters, but, you know, at nighttime, even in summer, you're going to feel a chill. And so the cuisine is designed to warm hands and bellies. You'll find quite a lot of soups and stews, comfort food, warming food, and often in one pot. So, you know, a massive big pot of noodle soup. Noodles feature quite large in the cuisine, and also breads. Those are usually flat breads because everything is cooked over a fire. So
on top of the stove, it's a top of the stove cooking, right?
Yes, that's right.
The bread looks, yes, I must compliment you. The fry bread look beautiful, absolutely, and delicious.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. There is a theory of the properties of foods, and I immediately thought of like the Renaissance humoral theories of healing foods and what, you know, the different properties of the foods. And you wrote that there is this also this theory in Tibetan culture about the foods are the hot, the cool, the neutral. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
This is quite similar to traditional Chinese medicine. And mm-hmm. in fact, many ways of perceiving food and understanding how that affects the body across Asia, so Ayurvedic medicine also to some degree. So Tibetan people perceive some foods to have what they call hot properties, so things like garlic, ginger, tomatoes. These are the kind of foods that you should eat more of if your body is cold. And if it's hot, then you should eat more cooling foods like yogurt or, say, cucumber. And then there are some foods that sit somewhere in between. And ideally, any Tibetan spread would have all of these foods represented so that everybody can have a little bit of everything or more of one kind or the other, depending on their unique constitution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I always sort of thought of the food, and I think you even mentioned a lot of people sort of think of the food of Nepal being, you know, Tibetan, but there really are, it's really different. But there is that that Northern Asian kind of influence very much. Yeah, I could see in a lot of the recipes.
Yes, I mean, Tibetan people have been traveling in Nepal and in India for a very long time. There's been trade, so salt moving out of Tibet and rice coming in, for example. And so obviously, some of the culinary influences from those regions have also made their way in and also out.
Right. I mean, the Himalayan salt is, you know, has just become wildly popular across the world. Right?
Yeah, it's example, like, you know, we say the Kashmir jumper or Kashmir sweater, and it's all the wools come from Tibet, and they're made in Kashmir. So where the very expensive Kashmir's all the wools come from Tibet. So that's the, you know, people things that were from Kashmir, but this is originally come from Tibet.
And in fact, when you talk about the salt that has become, as you say, wildly popular, most of that pink Himalayan salt, in fact, hails from Pakistan and not from Tibet. So Tibet also has its own wonderful salt flats, and many of Yixi's family members do work there. And he often says that that's really the only seasoning you need for a meal. It's so delicious when you are consuming salt that was produced just down the road. You know, it's so fresh, it's so delicious, you just don't need anything else. But yeah, there's so much movement between the regions that share that mountain range. There's much more could be said.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that the trade and sharing is quite prevalent. I mean, I just look at the beautiful decorations of the homes and the doorways and think, well, you know, this has materials that, you know, have to come from all kinds of different places. Mm. That's interesting.
And the better foods, like, you know, like freshness. And then just local ingredients. It does make everything fresh and really much tastier.
Mm. So there are some vegetables that were maybe not native to Tibet that have made their way in from other parts of the region. But, you know, once grown locally, that's the key. Eating always as close to home as possible.
Right.
Yeah, that's, you know, make you everything tastier and just healthier.
Right. And I think of, especially where, Yixi, is it Yixi or Yeshi?
Yeshi, yeah.
Yeshi. Okay. where your family, comes from, where you come from, is that it is very rural and very isolated, but, I mean, in this modern day, I mean, things do make their way everywhere, right?
That's right. The family have a greenhouse now, for example. That's a very kind of recent introduction. And most of the families in the village have one, or they share. And so it is possible now to grow some vegetables out of their normal seasons. So that's quite a new concept.
That's a great concept. Yeah.
but not one that is embraced by everybody, because one precept of Tibetan medicine is that in order for food to have the most kind of powerful effect on the body, that foods that are perceived to be hot in nature, for example, should be grown in a hot environment and cold, you know, in the cold. Right. And so to be growing them out of season is definitely kind of new, and many people feel untested.
You had mentioned that in the book, that it wasn't embraced 100% by the greenhouses that are making their way in. And Yeshi, at what altitude is your family's home?
I'm not sure exactly, but probably 2,500
meters. That is
meters. Yeah,
meters. Right. Right. Mm. So yeah. that's you know, as high as most of our mountains. No, not out west, but
that's you know, in Tibet, that's really very low altitude. So where Yeshi is from, there's an abundance of fruit and vegetables, a lot of soft fruits growing wild on the mountains, and two growing seasons in a year. So they're really very spoiled there. And, you know, when we talked a bit earlier about food in Tibet, you know, we could say from his region that there's a bounty, but, you know, in other parts of the region, the same definitely could not be said to be true.
I was really surprised to hear that there were two growing seasons. I read that, and that surprised me. That was great.
Yeah, we live in a valley, and and that is very close to the sun, and the land is very, very rich. And we use the on the land for the river clean water, and it's very quite easy to grow things.
So Tibet can be quite dry, but yes, if you live close to good water, as Yeshi's family do, then you're cooking with a lot more exciting ingredients, ultimately.
Right. Absolutely. Well, of course, I know that it is probably curious to a lot of people, and that is, how did you two meet?
Yeah, I was worried we hadn't mentioned that up until this point. So we are a couple.
Yes.
We met in India. So Yeshi left his home at around about the age of 19. So he has no actual record of his date of birth, but he knows he was born in the year of the sheep. So that gives him a rough idea. And he left by foot over the Himalayas to help his brother join the monastery in India. And he himself had no long-term plan to stay in India. His original intention was to return home, but he hadn't understood how long and the journey would take and how dangerous that would be. And it was a bit of a one-way ticket. And by the time we met he'd been living in India for about 10 years at that time. So I was in India on a work trip and living in China at the time. Actually, I used to be the editor of the Oxford Chinese Dictionary. So this is how we ended up in Oxford in the UK. Mm-hmm. But I did a kind of sideline in NGO work, and I had a week's work trip in India, on the end of which I tacked on a short break because I was interested to see what life looked like for Tibetan people in India. I had kind of snapshots of that inside China where I was living at the time. But obviously, I mean, I knew it would be different over on the other side. And so we met during that short week, just on a path in the foothills of the Himalayas on the Indian side. It was a kind of chance meeting.
Amazing who you might bump into, huh? it's a fascinating story. And of course, now you have two young children and a restaurant and a food stall and now a book, we hope to be, and I'm sure will be, a very popular book. It's a beautiful book, very colorful. And what I would like to do is talk more about these specific recipes. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the material culture of the dining, particularly in the rural areas, and it's described so well. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Like the tables, you said that rarely were there chairs or armchairs, but...
That's right. Well, if you think of, Tibetan people living their traditional lifestyle, they're mostly outdoors, and mm-hmm. and mealtimes are usually big gatherings of families who are living together, working together, helping each other. So they're quite an occasion, especially when you think that a lot of that work is hard physical work. So there's something quite sacred about mealtimes, that's a moment for rest and to give some, appreciation to what you are enjoying, stopping to take a moment to think about where it's come from and through the many hands through which it has traveled before it's reached the plate. And so good kind of time is set aside for meals in Tibet. And yes, those meals are often just taken wherever they land, and usually tables don't feature large, and nor really does tableware. So traditionally, Tibetan people would carry just one bowl for the purpose of eating whatever meal that was, and the bowl would have two parts, and there's a lid for taking tea, and Tibetans, especially nomads, will drink up to 60 cups a day of its butter tea. And this is something that people may have heard of.
And also they wear really high altitude and very cold, and they're middle of the bigger fires, and they sit around the fire. If we put the tables and then they block the fire.
So. Oh, that's true. I hadn't thought about that, right?
And the same in the home, actually. I mean, the fire is the centerpiece of the home, and there's no table next to it. So people will eat there, especially during wintertime when it's especially cold, and then maybe not leave the fireplace. They'll bed down there as well.
Well, you said the bowls, and I read that the lovely story about the bowls, and they are, many of them, mostly made out of wood.
That's right. So Yeshi's brother and his dad make their own bowls. So they're beautiful. So they're made usually from
the what called bar for the trees on the what called a bar.
Oh, the bough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or a knot from the tree, and they all have their, obviously the one, each piece comes out differently to the next. And traditionally Tibetans would carry one bowl for life. And we mentioned in the book, you know, that there's a popular song that likens these bowls to a lady lover, because they're held close to the bosom. They're kept inside the folds of the Tibetan cloak, which is always worn.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, kept very close and much treasured. Mm-hmm. I mean, these days, obviously, there are different kinds of bowls have made their way in. But that's a tradition that holds, because the wooden bowl, as Yeshe describes it, is never too hot for the hands to hold. And mostly these bowls are brought close to the mouth. So without a table, you're bringing your bowl close to the mouth to eat or to drink. And as he also says, you know, then it will never burn the mouth. So if you're drinking tea out of a wooden bowl, no matter how hot it is, when you're cold, you don't have to wait to enjoy that that cup.
Well, I mean, much has been written. If anyone knows anything about Tibetan food, I would imagine it's butter tea that they know about. So, Yeshe, can you describe what is butter tea and how does one make it?
Butter teas, we use the black tea, and some people use some little bit of milk, but then we butter a tea with a little bit of salt, and we use the butter, and then that's the, I don't know how to then
put it in a churn.
Put it in a churn, and if they're fresh, you know, it's just so delicious. I left Tibet in 1999, like 20 years, I just leave other country, and I went a few years back. I think I went there, just my family drinking the tea, just, you know, I joined with them, and just, I can't stop. It's so delicious.
Yeah. Well, and I would imagine provides you a lot of calories and energy for what you need to live in that cold environment too, right?
Yeah, this is also to give the energy, but it's just so delicious. And I think that's part is all, everything's fresh, and then also the water is so delicious, just mineral water. That's Mike says everything's food tested really good. And I just realize how food is just fantastic and delicious.
And is it primarily yak butter or whatever animals are being milked at the time?
But most in Tibet, yak butter. But yeah, some we have cow as well. So,
and we make this tea at home here in the UK. And we obviously, without yaks at our disposal, we make that with cow's butter. And it's so delicious.
And that's good. Oh, sounds great. Yeah.
I think an unfortunate thing is that many visitors to Tibet don't have the best experience of butter tea, because they are consuming it in parts of Tibet where the butter has lost its freshness, or it hasn't been stored correctly, or it's been kind of stored for an inordinate amount of time. And obviously any kind of butter in those conditions goes quite sour. And local people get used to that taste. But as outsiders, when we sample that kind of tea, you know, it's very hard to enjoy. So, you know, we hope that we could encourage people to give this recipe a go, even if they've had a bad experience previously.
Yeah, yeah. A little more rancid than just cultured butter. It's just
yes, that's right.
You talk about sampa. Sampa is pretty much would you say if there's one dish that is the most important dish, would it be sampa?
I think, yeah, the sampa is like we like it, eat to all the area in Tibet. Mm. And like we can say it like a sampa eater means.
Tibetans like sometimes call themselves Tibet, the land of the sampa eaters, because no matter where you are in Tibet, that is a unifying custom, a unifying culinary tradition. So many other culinary traditions may vary from region to region, but the one that all Tibetans share is a love of sampa.
Hmm.
So that's
again the roasted barley flour, just mixed with water, right?
Yeah, I mean, our kids are usually butter as well. There's a theme here.
I see that.
But our kids also enjoy it with cheese. So that's the way that they eat it for breakfast. Mm. So a little bit of hot water and butter and cheese. But even without the cheese, even without the butter, it makes for a really kind of nutty, delicious snack.
And I love how it's everything's worked with the hands. The hands are so important. Mm. And I'm assuming those are your hands I see in the photographs, Yeshi.
Oh, yes. You know, generally, you know, I think the many, like any country, I'm sure it used to be by hand, you know.
Yes.
So we lost from that. But that's the idea of this book. Mm. You know, we somewhere we need to understand where the foods come from. And so how then, so hopefully this book, so the people can learn a little bit to
get a little bit kind of a closer connection with food.
Yeah.
And hands mm-hmm. come into that equation, you know, eating with your hands and also,
definitely.
Yeah, it also helps to make the food taste better.
Mm. Yeah. You know, during the pandemic, and we were all locked down, suddenly there was a craze for baking bread.
Mm.
And I think a large part of it was, you know, that again, like you said, having that connection again with the food, the kneading of the dough with your hands, touching the dough and, you know, and squeezing it and working it. And I think it gave people comfort.
Mm, I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
And, you know, although obviously now, yeah, she's here in the UK and there's all kinds of food processors that we have at our disposal. He doesn't, especially in home cooking, ever use those. Mm. I think he, you know, he never gets tired of cooking. And I think that you can tire when you rely too much on that kind of equipment, you know, but when mm-hmm. you're actually investing the time and energy and using your hands in that way, there's definitely a pleasure to be gained.
Yeah. At your food stall or it, your restaurant, Taste Tibet, do you serve any sampa at all?
We
or is
serve,
just a home dish?
We serve it in one form only, which is, and there's a recipe for this in the book, chocolate samba truffles. So we serve it as our kind of only sweet offering, because as we've mentioned in the book, Tibetans don't really have a culture of sweet treats except around the Lunar New Year time when they're widely and wildly enjoyed. And so we don't really have much in the same way we don't have much in the restaurant in the way of sweet offerings, but sometimes people crave something sweet after their meal. So we serve these chocolate samba truffles, and that's a really nice way of introducing people to the idea of samba. And our customers love them.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, we're going to take a short break right now. And when we come back, I want to go through a couple of these recipes and describe the dishes that are very different. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
In the heart of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Lilia combines wood-fired seafood, handcrafted pasta, classic Italian cocktails, and warm hospitality. Since 2016, it's been celebrated as a neighborhood gathering place, bringing the best of Italy to New York City. Lilia is one of over 8,000 restaurants that leverage Bento Box to power their digital front door, including their website, gift cards, event management, and more. Bento Box is a marketing and commerce platform built specifically for the hospitality industry. With Bento Box, get discovered, make more money, and engage your diners so you can deliver great hospitality both in person and online. Visit getbento.com/chef today to learn more and get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
Hey everyone, I'm Jesse Sparks, host of the new podcast, The One Recipe, from the team behind The Splendid Table. This pod is all about that one recipe that you lean on. the one you share with friends, the one you make when you need a little love, and the one you know will work every single time. Every week, I talk with chefs and gifted cooks from all over the world about their one and the story behind it. We're here to help you build your kitchen library one dish at a time. Follow the one recipe wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back, and I'm speaking with Julie Kleeman and Yeshi Jampa. They are the authors of a new book called Taste Tibet, Family Recipes from the Himalayas. And Taste Tibet is also the name of their restaurant and food stall in Oxford. And I guess a lot of people who are studying in the Oxford, or just visiting and traveling tourists, have had the opportunity to sample your momos. Can you tell us about momos and what they are?
Momos is a Tibetan name, and so momos eat old Tibet area, so it's a kind of a national dish. It's just so delicious.
It's a steamed dumpling.
Yeah.
Well, what's not to like about a steamed dumpling, right?
Using whatever kind of fillings you might have to hand. So, you know, if you happen to have meat at that point, you use meat, and yak meat is the traditional meat used, but beef makes a great substitute. And having said that, you know, chicken or pork work just as well if you prefer white meat. But yes, she also remembers growing up delicious veggie momos made with vegetables just picked from the field next to the house.
Yeah, my mom, she makes it like, you know, squashed all the pak choy and with a little bit of salt.
Oh, yeah,
and just, you know, she makes delicious fresh and veggie momos. That's really, I remember of it.
Oh, we're getting to that season here now, where maybe some of the ramps are coming up and some of the new garlic, and I could see mixing all that in with some greens. Okay, a veggie momo is fine with me.
The one in the book that we call the Heavenly Vegan Momos, that's the one that we serve at the restaurant and at the food and festival stall. And that one uses, I think in the US you call them garlic scrapes.
So scapes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that it's a really kind of nice bite, gives a nice bite, whatever you mix it with. We usually use sweetheart cabbage and spinach, but you know, you can, as we said, and this is very much kind of in line with how Tibetan cuisine works in general, you know, whatever you have to hand and you feel would make a good mix, but we recommend those garlic scapes.
You know what I loved for several reasons? I loved the look. I loved the ease. And that is the buckwheat pancakes. They look like lace doilies on a plate. They're absolutely beautiful. And you don't have to let them sit and ferment or anything, which is usually when I've used buckwheat in any kind of a bread type, you know, recipe, it's always had to sit and ferment a little bit. But these you can make straight away, right?
Yeah, this is just fresh. This is so delicious. So sometimes often in the breakfast I make here, but in my home, so yeah, this is just when I was little, they make my mom's. So if I say I'm making here, that she just, she loves it.
So it's just eggs and buckwheat flour, and there you go. I mean, you're ready to go, but just beautiful too. I'm going to give that a try. I know noodles are very popular. Of course, you know, we're traveling maybe a little lower to a lot of other grains, so you're able to use some wheat flour, and I like the fact that they're all hand pulled noodles. Can you tell me about the noodles and the importance in those dishes?
And the noodles in Tibet is very, very popular, and it's very good because they're very cold, and mostly kind of the dinner times Tibetan people eat noodles not that heavy. Mm-hmm. And then
and also that's when it's coldest. So in the evening, everybody needs, these noodles are usually served in broth. So you do get fried noodles, and that's quite popular amongst young people at any time of day. But elderly people enjoy soup noodles in the evening. As you say, they're perceived to be light, but warming. there's quite a lot of delicious broth there too. So it's not all about the noodles.
And what about the hand pulling, Yeshi? So you cut the noodles after you make the dough, and then you cut the noodles, and then tell me about pulling them.
When you pull out a little bit, the dough makes the quick skinny, and then pull the quarter make it easier to pull it. And the
he's doing the actions as he's talking.
I can almost see it. You know.
So yeah, that's it. Makes it very nice. You can the thinner and to top to end. Mm. With the back pull like that with the, in the hand, and you can make the which one size precisely and perfect.
But you know, you can do noodles any which way, and actually a really popular way of enjoying noodles in Tibet is these hand pulled noodles. So that's the first dish that Yeshi ever served me, and those are made from long strips of dough, and you pinch the end off the strip and throw these bits into the broth. And so you end up with kind of squares, more like pasta, I guess, than noodles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Squared noodles. But there's so many ways of doing it. And we presented various different ways in the book, but we also encourage people to just stick with the way that they feel works for them, because the taste is pretty much the same, however you do it. Noodles are made with just plain flour and water, sometimes egg as well. If you eat
the high gluten flour.
Yes, right. Yeah, exactly. Anything with a high gluten content. So Yeshi often recommends like a kind of pizza flour, anyway, a strong white flour.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly pulling them makes them springier, a little lighter and springier. Right?
I think that's what he's trying to say. That's certainly springy. What I could see in his movement.
Well, I know the picture of him pulling it, and I can see that too. What are jelly noodles? Now, this is a real Tibetan dish, right? I mean,
noodles like very popular, like in the summer, and some people in like a little bit of town and the city, they're selling outside in the street.
Street food.
This kind of street food, and people eat quick kind of that in the summer.
So they're always served chilled. That's the important thing to say. Uh-huh. And always with this the very fiery sopen chili condiment, because in of themselves, the jelly noodles are quite tasteless. They've got an interesting texture, but it's the additional flavors that you bring to this dish, sesame oil, soy sauce, and crucially, chili.
And the garlic.
Garlic as well.
Garlic,
that's right. Yeah. That gives it all the flavor. And it's the perfect kind of street food snack in hot summer in Tibet. It does get hot. I mean, it's hot in winter, during the daytime.
As Yeshi said, you're very close to the equator. I mean, the sun is very...
You're very close to the sun, right. Yeah. And so in summertime, it can get very hot. And this is a very refreshing dish. But as he mentioned, I don't think this is a dish you came across until you went to towns and cities yourself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's more of a kind of urban thing.
Yeah. Well, now the sepan is, I know, very important in your restaurants, your establishment. But, and, of course, it's in my home, it's very important too, although it's not sepan. And now we have all different kinds of, and I can't wait to make your recipe.
I was going to say, you must try
keep
this
it in
one.
Jar. Yeah, yeah, definitely. So describe for our listeners what sepan is.
What's important about it is that actually in of itself, Tibetan cuisine is usually not that spicy. So it's very kind of simple, warming, comforting flavors that most of your listeners will be very familiar with. But always on hand at the Tibetan dinner table, you'll have this fiery, it's called sopen chili dip, which people will add a little or a lot to depending on how much they enjoy it. And every family will have its own unique recipe, but the kind of essential ingredient is apart from chili itself, and we use like hot chili flakes, is something called yama, which in the West we know as Sichuan peppercorn. And that has a kind of tongue-tingling effect. Mm-hmm. So the chili is not a kind of quick hit. It's a very kind of, well, it's slow-cooked with garlic and with ginger, And so it has a very kind of slow release heat that also gives you this kind of what's going on my tongue kind of feeling as well. So it's a very interesting, a kind of complex and delicious addition to whatever, almost whatever you're cooking, maybe except the buckwheat pancakes.
It's just, I can see always having as I will do with many dishes, and having a jar or a bowl of this seppan around to scoop on.
The food lovers, they have some chili always. Yaman is like most like saltiness, and the ton, I mean, kind of that. It's really, really good, spicy.
Yaman grows, I was going to say everywhere in Tibet, but in any case, everywhere around where you're from, Yeshi.
The we grow like a really organic, just around their house. They have a lot.
Bushes.
And is it the seed, or is it, you have to wait till it's dried, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, you can use the fresh as well, but it's dry. The dry we can get here. You can get it like any Chinese supermarket that you can get. Good one.
It's best to buy it whole, and then you can kind of crush it yourself. Right. But you can also buy it in its crushed form. It just obviously loses something of its aroma and freshness that way.
Mm-hmm. Something else. There are so many dishes, and we can't talk about them all, and people have to buy the book so they can find out what they are. But I'm thinking of hand pies, they'd be like British pasties. I mean,
a lot of people in our restaurant find it hard to believe that this is a traditional Tibetan dish, right? Because it looks like a Cornish pasty.
Right. But and what's it? Shabalep?
Shabalep.
And those, of course, look like they'd be, a super treat for anyone.
And we would encourage people, because we gave a recipe only for the meat version there, which is the really traditional one that you get in tea houses, especially in Lhasa, the capital of Tibet. Right, but we would encourage people to also go for it, even if they're vegan or vegetarian, with one of the momo fillings, whichever one kind of tickles their fancy. Because, these are delicious veggie as well as meaty.
Yeah, this is a very, very popular in my restaurant now.
Well, I see that, Yeshi, you have developed so many different recipes that are more, that aren't perhaps any that you grew up with, but with the influences of the Indian cuisine and other cuisines, and now living in England. But one thing that caught my attention particularly is that a lot of the dishes that are like composed salads or look like a stir fry, but they're not a stir fry, are made with cooking the meat first and then chilling it and cutting and mixing the cold meat in with the other ingredients. I've found that very interesting.
That's kind of the meat, kind of a salad.
Right. That's what it looked like, a salad. Yes, a salad.
Yeah, it's just like this with salad. It's just a really side dish. And if people like the drinks and they have beer with the whiskey, whatever, it's just in Tibet, it's very, very popular.
I think this idea of cooking the meat first and then chilling it probably comes about because, if watching how Yeshi cooks is anything to go by, usually you're not cooking in small quantities in Tibet. So if you have a piece of meat, you'll usually have come by a large piece of meat. And so some of that meat, when you first cook it, you will enjoy hot, but then you're going to chill the rest of it for kind of multiple different uses over the course of time. So I think that's how that technique has come about. You're always dealing in kind of large quantities of something, and then how best to use what you have left over. And
leftovers,
and by all means,
make
sure that you always use it.
It's like, example, like in my family, like we have like 12 people in one family. And it's just a big family, like in here, it's very, very different. And it's a very, very cultural, and everything's different.
And because everybody will always eat together, make time to celebrate, every meal time. And so, yes, you're always cooking large quantities of whatever it is, and then this comes about with your leftovers.
Yeah.
Is there any particular dish or recipe that you that you would like to mention or talk about that you feel is really that illustrates the cuisine in your mind?
You know, for me, it's tantou. I mentioned this recipe before. It's the hand-pulled noodle soup. I think that is universally enjoyed, loved across Tibet, and is so important for warmth. You know, it's one that's enjoyed by the fire at a nomadic camp, but it's also one that we cook here probably once a week, regardless of the season, because there's just something so incredibly comforting about it. For me, I don't know about for you.
For me, it's like the momo is the really, really, it's not that difficult. And it's just for me, so when I was a young age, mama cooks the vegetable momos. I just really, really.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's just family together and easy and delicious. And with the mac with the sauce, so important to go with the momo. I think it's just momo's the best.
Yes. Well, and as I said before, who doesn't love a dumpling? You know, that's wonderful. Well, it is just a pleasure to speak with you both. And this book, it makes the book come to life even more. But it really, as I said, I could see the influences of both of you in here so well. And it is a wonderful book. And it really does put Tibetan cuisine on the map. As I said in the beginning, it sheds new insight into that. And the stories are so important too. As you wrote about the Buddhist theory of the mindful eating and the show reverence to food, you mentioned right from the beginning that think about where it's a quiet time to think about where the food comes from. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Linda. I mean, it's wonderful to hear that we have been able to bring the cuisine and the culture to life. And thank you so much for having us on.
More than welcome. And just, I wanted to say just a word about spices before I just realized it was something that that I was curious about. And obviously you have the pepper flakes, but what spices in particular are you feel more indigenous to most of the areas that are used in the food? Would it be cumin? Would it be coriander leaves or seeds? What in particular?
I think we grow cumin's wildly, and the coriander, just we don't need, like in my home area, just don't need plant every year because just grow back.
Because it grows wild, right?
Yeah, and just we always available, but and the chili as well, like different chili and very skinny chili we have at the Himalaya area. It just it's hot, but it's just like not that hard. It's a soft, and I think the Himalaya area, this the chili is a little bit different, but it's a very, very nice one.
Mm. And of course, the universal love for garlic.
I was going to say garlic, ginger.
Yeah, the garlic is just really, really.
Garlic makes it.
Yeah, garlic is so good. Yeah, we have so much garlic in my home. Always like hang around on the roof.
Well, I encourage people that if you are in the area of Oxford to check out Taste Tibet, either the food stall or the restaurant. Is the restaurant located? Now, the food stall is in the food market, right, the open-air food market.
Well, we used to have a food stall there, but then when we opened our restaurant, we now only operate in that kind of mobile way at festivals. But we go to, you know, Glastonbury and the biggest festivals in the land. So, Yeshi loves that, to be in a field and, you know, in the tent.
Still, we are nomadic.
Exactly.
Reminds you of home, yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Oh, well, that's wonderful. Well, so check out Taste Tibet. And that the restaurant is in Oxford, correct?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Linda.
And of course, the book, you can find the book now on your bookseller's shelves. It's called Taste Tibet. And again, the authors, my guests, Julie Kleeman and Yeshi Jampa, Family Recipes from the Himalayas, Taste Tibet. Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure. I could just keep on talking, but
so could we. Thank you, Linda.
I know my engineer has to get going too, so we will have to end it now. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you, my guests. Thank you for listening in. And remember that Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported station. So you go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the donate button in the upper right corner and show us some love. It'll keep us on the airways, okay? And you can also find the podcasts wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks so much. Keep listening.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.